Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we find out about a colloquium this weekend at Brock looking at the changing face of theater criticism in the digital age. We hear about research being done on the role animals play in promoting basic social and emotional competencies in children. And we talk to a pair of graduate students in the Master of Arts in Classics program about a day-long conference they held earlier this month on the theme of International History of Slavery. Radio for the Theater of the Mind. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. We welcome you to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM, and we begin in the theatrical arena. We've often heard the phrase, everyone's a critic these days. In this digital age, that seems to be the case more than ever, with the rise of blogging and Twitter, for example, along with the decline of print journalism. But this raises important questions about what counts as legitimate professional criticism in this brave new world in which we live. At Brock University, February 21st and 22nd, media professionals, theater experts, scholars, and students will all assemble in the Sankey Chamber at Brock to take part in the colloquium, The Changing Face of Theater Criticism in the Digital Age, hosted by the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts. Dr. Karen Fricker, event coordinator and a professor of dramatic arts at Brock, joined us in our CFBU-FM studios recently to talk about the event, and since she's a self-described newbie in her first year teaching at Brock, I asked about her experiences at the university so far.
Oh, it's been absolutely fantastic. I arrived in January last year, January 2013, into the Department of Dramatic Arts and hit the ground running. And it's a terrific time to be at Brock working in the fine and performing arts, because there's so much excitement around the upcoming opening of the new facility downtown, a sense of growth and building and contributing to something that's really on the up and up.
So you're going to be in that new complex downtown.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. And not long at all.
I wrote in my arts blog in the weekend about the fact that everything that is happening now will transfer to the downtown site, and isn't that going to be wonderful? For example, if you're right in the downtown working or something, you can just walk over and watch a performance in the evening, the Tuesday recitals at noon hour. You can catch a discussion, and it's all right here, right at our fingertips. We're going to be so lucky to have this facility right here in the heart of St. Catharines.
I agree, and it's exciting for us who work in fine and performing arts at Brock to think about the fact that our teaching, all of our activity is moving into the downtown core. We're no longer going to be based up on campus. I mean, we're going to need to go up there for meetings and to use the library, right? But our teaching and learning is going to happen here in downtown St. Catharines, which is an area that needs a boost, right? We need to bring more life into downtown. We need to hopefully, I mean, what we're all investing in terms of our belief, and we're going to be wanting to invest our capital as well in seeing more activity, more restaurants, more cafes, more shops here in downtown to support the fact that we are going to have so much more culture available to us.
It's also nice that you're here during the 50th anniversary year for Brock. Fortuitous for you that you come for the celebrations of what began 50 years ago.
And for me, that's quite unusual because I come from California, so I come from a relatively new place, but I did my doctoral training at Trinity College Dublin, which is hundreds and hundreds of years old. So the notion of the newness of Brock and the fact that it's only 50 years old, that's exciting and different for me. And it's important, I think, for all of us who work at Brock and live in the region to understand the history of the place and how much it's contributed to providing higher education initially for local people.
So even though you're a newbie, Brock, for you, is a newbie in the overall scheme. scheme of things, considering where you've been.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, so let's talk about the conference coming up on the weekend at Brock, the changing face of theater criticism in the digital age. Has this been something, a bit of a burning issue for you? This is giving you finally an opportunity to address this issue because you now are in a university setting?
Absolutely. I came here to Brock from College of the University of London, so I've been in an academic job for 6 years and training in my PhD before that. But my career for 20 years has been as a theater critic. And when I first started writing theater criticism, this was before the internet existed. And when I sent my first pitches in to try and get my reviews into papers, I sent hard copy letters to editors and then called them up on the phone, which feels like a long time ago. The advent of the internet has really changed, obviously, how we do business and how we communicate globally. It's really changed the way that arts criticism works and is challenging a lot of established understandings of issues like authority and power and legitimacy. And this has happened to me in my lifetime, in my profession. It's affected the way that I do business. And this is indeed an opportunity for me to address these issues with peers, with senior figures in the field, from abroad and from the critical scene in Toronto, with a particular focus on asking, what does this have to do with us here in Niagara?
So what does it have to do with us here
in
Niagara?
Well, as we've already mentioned, the arts infrastructure in Niagara is growing and is going to take an exponential leap up when the new Performing Arts Center at Brock, the new home of the Marilyn I. Walker School for the Fine and the Performing Arts, opens in 2015, and along with it, the new municipal facility. The amount of arts that are going to be shown in the region are going to jump up. And I think that as an arts person, as a theater person, this is incredibly welcome. But I'm looking around and I'm seeing a critical infrastructure that is frankly lacking. We don't have much arts criticism at all in Niagara. We have the Sun Media papers, and they have one arts reporter who's on that beat, seems to me to be incredibly overworked, trying to cover that entire beat. I look at that and I see a hole and I see an opportunity. And so part of what I'm doing in my work at Brock is teaching theater criticism to our undergraduates, because I think it's really important that students be able to think and write critically, full stop. If I happen to turn a couple of these young people into passionate advocates and practitioners of informed, smart arts criticism, who might want to find ways and outlets in order to put their responses to local arts out there on the airwaves, on the internet, in print, well, that will be a really good outcome as well.
So what kind of response are you getting from these students? Because for a lot of them who have been brought up in this digital age, actually learning how to do constructive criticism may seem a novel idea to them.
It's been a massive learning curve for the students. Our students in dramatic arts at Brock are fantastic young people. They're wide open, they're incredibly creative, and they're used to learning through practice. We call it a praxis approach. That's our word for it. Everything that we theorize, we do, and everything that we do, we theorize. It's a BA degree, right? And so it has an academic core through it. But everything that we talk about doing, we actually do. And so theater criticism is a way of putting into practice being a critical thinker and looking at theater and taking it apart and breaking it down for parts and putting it back together again and talking about what was attempted and was it, in our educated view, a successful attempt. I think that initially the students have articulated a lot in discussion and in reflection papers, a lot of questions like, who might ask this question? What authority do I have to evaluate somebody else's practice? But that's a question that we could ask of every single person who says anything on the internet these days, right? In this age of TripAdvisor and Yelp culture, the idea of the citizen critic, of people talking back and saying, well, I went to that hotel and it doesn't look at all like it does on the website. We find that very valuable as consumers, right? And that's happening in arts criticism as well, particularly through comment strands and people's own personal blogs. So what place does an educated, informed voice have in that new evolving maelstrom of voices? That's a question that I'm asking in the class, and that's a question that we're asking in the conference. And I try and say to my students, well, you're theater students, you're theater people, you love drama, or you wouldn't be doing a drama degree. So I think that you do know something, you do have authority. And as long as you can construct a good argument and undergird what you say in your review with proof, then you absolutely have the right to speak. And that to me is a very powerful thing, that there's a politics in that. Letting young people know that they have a right to speak in the world.
So the conference comes up. It's Friday and a Saturday. Let's talk about the panel. Who have you got coming? Because a lot of these people will have read and know quite well.
Absolutely. The whole peg for the conference happening at all is a program that we have at Brock called the Walker Cultural Leader Series, which is endowed by Marilyn I. Walker, who's also endowed the new facility. And it is a way of bringing major thinkers and major creators amongst us in the School of Fine and Performing Arts at Brock. And my invitee for this series this year is a woman called Jill Dolan, who is a theater academic and blogger based at Princeton in the States. And Jill is a senior figure in my field. Anybody who does theater studies in the Anglophone world will know her name. She is an important figure in feminist theater criticism. And she wrote an important book back in the 80s called The Feminist Spectator as Critic, in which she brought feminist politics to the idea of looking at and evaluating theater. And it's now a central text. And relatively late in her trajectory as an academic, she became a blogger, which I think was just a fantastically open-minded and innovative thing for her to do. She had absolutely nothing to prove in the academic world. And yet, she wanted to take the opportunity of these new technologies that allow her to blog, to set up a blog and go, to do feminist criticism of theater and popular culture. And she won an important award a couple of years ago in the States, the George Jean Nathan Award for Drama Criticism, which is the highest award that a drama critic can win in the States. It comes with a healthy cash prize. And she was the first blogger ever to win. And that was a really important moment, I think, for the legitimation of online criticism. Everybody else who'd won it before had been a print critic and or a scholar. And Jill and I have been having an ongoing conversation for a number of years about what does it mean to do feminist criticism on the web? What does it mean to be a blogger? How has this affected her practice? So she's coming to be amongst us at Brock and to do a number of activities, including participating in this conference that we're calling The Changing Face of Theater Criticism in the Digital Age. Other people that are going to be on the panel include J. Kelly Nestrick, who's the theater critic of the Globe and Mail, and Richard Azunian, who's the theater critic of the Toronto Star. And these gentlemen are the most powerful theater critics in Canada. They're based in Toronto, and obviously this is a massive country, but Toronto is the biggest Anglophone theater center in the country. And Kelly in particular, who's in his 30s, a very young, vibrant figure, very active on social media as well as in print, travels a lot and writes a lot about, he was just in Montreal, he's going to Calgary, and he's trying to develop a practice to be a national theater critic, which is interesting and we can talk to him about. Richard Azunian, interestingly, does not social network and has some strong feelings about whether or not criticism, particularly using social media, is that even a legitimate part of a critical practice. So I'm looking forward to a spirited debate between those gentlemen, Jill Dolan, and several other panelists, and that is on Saturday morning at 10 o'clock.
That will be fireworks for sure.
Absolutely. And, you know, let's have this conversation because it is brewing. And I'm really happy to have been able to create the opportunity for this dialogue to happen here at Brock. And it's not only a live event, which anybody in the community can come along to. It's in Sankey Chambers at Brock. We're also going to be live streaming it on the internet and live tweeting under the hashtag DartCritics. So people can follow along virtually, even if they're not able to come along and be present materially.
The prospect of online opinions, it's a two-edged sword, I think. And we talked about this a few moments ago, because everyone has their own particular axe to grind. It quite often will color their opinion on whatever they're talking about.
All criticism is subjective.
True.
There's a kind of a mythology that circulates that there is such thing as this objective critic. But is Kelly Nestrick, the theater critic of the Globe and Mail, objective? Of course not. Kelly Nestrick is an individual person with a particular background, with a particular politics and identity that is inevitably going to color what he says about theater. And let's celebrate that. As long as we accept that every piece of criticism that we read is coming from somebody's particular perspective and point of view, if those are the conditions under which we understand criticism, I think we'd be on an even footing to begin with, understanding what is this thing called criticism. The challenge at the moment, I think, for the consumer is how do you filter all of these points of view that are bombarding you on the internet? How do you figure out what the best blogs are to read? What do we call authority anymore? In what does it rest? It used to be, when I started being a theater critic, that the authority rested in the outlet. And to a certain extent, that's still the case. Like, Kelly Nestrick and Richard Azunian are powerful critics because they're smart guys who know what they're talking about, who write for major newspapers. I would also point out that they're two white men. There is a massive problem, not just in Toronto, but in every urban center in which I practice criticism, which are many. I started my career in New York. I worked in Dublin. I worked in London, UK. And now I'm here in St. Catharines observing the Toronto scene as well as the Niagara scene. It is still an extremely male-dominated field. And to me, that's a big problem. And so we need to figure out how we can use the technology of the internet and social media to enable more, better, diverse voices offering different perspectives about criticism. But the challenge that we all face, and this is still something that I'm figuring out for myself and trying to figure out with my students, who are, of course, digital natives, how do we get their voices heard? How do these smart young people get read? How do they make their voices discernible and audible in the brouhaha of the internet? We do have a blog. It's called dartcritics.com, and I would advise listeners to go there so you can read just how smart and insightful these young people are, and also maybe read about some theater that you didn't know was happening. My next challenge, the blog now exists, and the next challenge for me is figuring out how to get more hits. And that's a whole set of practices and knowledges that I don't have yet that I need to get, is how do you make sure they come up on search engines? How can we use social media to get the word out that there are some smart young people blogging about theater at Brock? What's exciting is all of that discovery is still in front of us.
Where do you think the future of theater criticism lies then? We've seen in the past print media dominating. It's not going to in the future. As a matter of fact, print media overall is not doing well in this day and age. So what does the future hold?
Well, the future is online, that's for sure. I'll talk a little bit about a practice that we're engaging with as part of this class, which I don't think is the only kind of critical activity that I would kind of support and advocate going forward. But it's an interesting new pathway. We're calling it embedded criticism, which is a knowing reference to the notion of embedded journalism that came out during recent Gulf Wars. The notion of a journalist being inside with a military unit reporting from the site. Embedded criticism is placing a theater expert, a theater journalist, a theater critic inside the making of a show and then having them write about that experience in an ongoing way in a blog format. And what this does is that it opens up the reader, the prospective spectator's understanding of how creativity works in a theater context, because we're saying it's not just you pay your ticket, you go, the lights go up, and a show happens. There's a whole creative process, a whole set of decisions, a whole set of explorations that went into making this piece of theater. And it is our belief, my belief, that many spectators are really interested in that. They want to know how this meal was cooked, right? That's engaging to them. And the internet opens up the possibility of this because of the notion of a blog being something that's ongoing that can continually be added to. This is something that is being enabled because of these new technologies. Now, an embedded critic would not be well advised to then go on and review the show in a traditional format. My students are embedded in 7 different creative processes in the region and in Toronto. For example, a group of them were just observing a production called London Road, which has been much talked about, which is a verbatim musical that was just at Canadian Stage in Toronto, directed by Jackie Maxwell, the artistic director of the Shaw Festival. And this had to be done absolutely with the consent of Canadian Stage and of Jackie Maxwell. They were fantastically cooperative and open to the young people coming and meeting them and finding out what they're doing and asking questions and observing rehearsals and then writing about it. The openness of the theater community and the infrastructure to this has been absolutely welcome and made me just feel like, wow, it's really lucky to be at Brock and to be in Toronto where people are so open to this. The rest of the class reviewed the show, but the 5 of them who were following the making of the show did not. And I think we're finding that that's a really good decision because those who were inside said, I could never review that show. I was well on the subjective register. You get completely on the side of the show and you feel like you have so much insider knowledge that you're not doing the standard job of writing a review as we understand it, that we're used to reading in the journalistic media. Embedded criticism is added value. It's something else. It's a new part of the dialogue. I'm not saying it is going to replace reviewing, but it is sitting alongside reviewing. And it is something like dramaturgy. There's a person in most theaters these days who's called a dramaturg, who's kind of the literary / intellectual person on the team, who's inside advising a creative process. Embedded critic is kind of like that person, but they're creating knowledge that is facing outwards toward the public. They're creating outputs, and that's really interesting to me. We're going to be having a panel discussing embedded criticism and its potentials on the Friday coming up. The whole conference goes from 2 till 6. The first panel is going to be about the arts and criticism in Niagara specifically, and then the second panel is about embedded criticism. I'm bringing in colleagues from New York City and London, UK, who practice embedded criticism. Jackie Maxwell is going to be on the panel talking about her interest in this practice, and I'm going to be on the panel talking about it from the perspective of pedagogy of my students. And my students will be in the room also contributing their own experiences.
Okay, so the live streaming will be on as well, so people will be able to live stream. You'll be tweeting.
Yep.
Okay, so it's totally interactive.
Absolutely.
And it's free to the public.
It's free to the public. It's a community event, which is absolutely part of what the Walker Cultural Leaders series is about. We are having a closed session where my students get to have the amazingly valuable experience of a masterclass with Jill Dolan. Like, what an incredible privilege for them. Then the Walker Cultural Leaders events open up to the public at 10 a.m. on Friday, where Jill's going to be giving an address about feminism and theater. This is in Sankey Chambers at Brock from 10 to 12. Then the conference is from 2 to 6, also in Sankey, on Friday, and Saturday from 10 to 1. Completely open, free to the public. Everyone is welcome. Please come along. If you can't physically be there, you can watch the live stream. We'll be able to ask questions on your computer that we will be able to read and respond to in the conference so that somebody can be virtually present and interacting with us.
Something you could not have done maybe even 5 years
yes.
ago.
Our ability to be virtually present is really bringing a lot of possibilities for us in doing teaching and learning. For example, I've had expert visitors to my theater criticism class from Edinburgh, from New York. We're going to have somebody speaking to us from Toronto. Somebody doesn't have to physically fly over in order to interact with my students and to share knowledge with them. And that's kind of extraordinary. And we're doing everything we can to kind of exploit the virtual possibilities of these technologies in the conference, because it's everything that we're talking about. We're talking about how technology is revolutionizing how we communicate about and through the arts.
Dr. Fricker, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And that was Brock Professor of Dramatic Arts, Dr. Karen Fricker, the event coordinator for the colloquium, The Changing Face of Theater Criticism in the Digital Age, on this Friday and Saturday in the Sankey Chamber at Brock. Thanks to community support from a local Niagara school board and a dog therapy program, a Brock University professor is researching the role animals play in promoting basic social and emotional competencies in children. The project, led by developmental psychologist Christine Tardif-Williams, is looking at children from St. David's Public School who have been taking part in a Reading Buddy program offered by Therapy Tales Ontario, a nonprofit group based in Welland. Dr. Tardif-Williams, associate professor and graduate program director in the Department of Child and Youth Studies at Brock, joined us in our CFBU studios earlier this week to talk about the research she's doing into this and other child studies at Brock. I asked Dr. Tardif-Williams what prompted her to begin this latest research project.
Well, I was approached about a year ago by Tina Hill from Therapy Tales Ontario, and she really had a vision for the research that she was hoping to be able to do. So their organization, Therapy Tales Ontario, has been bringing therapy dogs to various local organizations, including school boards. So within classrooms, they go to Pathstones, Mental Health. They're really interested in bringing together children and youth and therapy dogs, because intuitively they see the benefit of linking and pairing children with animals, particularly dogs. So they've been doing this for years, and they're very passionate about it. So Tina and her husband, Stuart, are extremely passionate about this. And they've received some Ontario Trillium funding to be able to do this. And so intuitively, they know it works. The educators, the professionals, the mental health professionals, they know it works, or they intuitively feel that it works. And so Tina approached me about a year ago asking if I'd be interested in partnering with them, which was a really exciting opportunity for me. So I got really excited about this. She had the vision. And so we decided about a year ago to kind of get the ball rolling and to begin to conceptualize what the research study might look like and who might be involved. So we began to put together a research ethics sort of application. So we approached one of the principals at the St. David's Public School, because she actually was very excited about this project as well. And so she had Therapy Tales Ontario coming in for the past 2 or 3 years And so again, she's engaged in this activity, the kids at her school, the parents. So the dogs would come in and the children would read to the dogs every week for about 20 minutes. And they had been doing this over at least 2 or 3 years. So we approached the principal at the St. David's Public School, Tammy Chilcott, and she was really excited about this. So we saw that we had this momentum where a number of potential collaborators were really interested in the same project, already doing this. And I had been, I suppose, doing some research during the day, but doing some nighttime reading in the area of companion animal bond for children and youth. So this was sort of my nighttime passion that I had been sharing with a colleague at Brock University, Dr. Sandra Bazzacchi in the Faculty of Education. So we would get together, have lunch at Brock, and be talking about this other passion that we had about the role of animals and the lives of children and youth and empathy development and, you know, what role do animals have in promoting pro-sociality and empathy in children and youth. And so we'd been talking about this, we'd been thinking about this, and actually we did a study with the Hamilton Burlington Humane Society, SPCA. And so it was a preliminary pilot study. So again, this was really exciting when Tina Hill approached us. And Tammy Chilcott, the principal at St. David's Public School, said, hey, here's an opportunity. So Sandra and I sort of jumped on this and thought that this would be a great opportunity to begin to do some program evaluation to see what is the impact of bringing these dogs in every week and having children read to them. Is there any benefit for the kids? So we began to do our research collaboration.
I was wondering why it was that school, but it was simply a case of there was already a connection there between the groups that are involved in this, that it seemed like a logical progression to actually go with that school. And the kids would have been familiar with the program anyway, so you didn't have to introduce them to it cold.
Exactly. No, the children were already reading. It was a logical connection, a place to start. And also really, I think, to validate some of the work that was already taking place, to really do some program evaluation, because as I say, the principal is really excited about this. Obviously, not everyone feels the same about bringing therapy dogs in contact with children, and she was very excited about this. So we thought, well, this is a really good place to start. And it was. It turned out it was great, and we're collecting our post-test data right now, and we'll begin to analyze that data very shortly. But Therapy Tales Ontario actually goes to various organizations locally, and so there are other possibilities to explore the connection between animals in a clinical setting for kids who have or are experiencing mental health challenges as well. So that's still a possibility, but we've started here for now.
So how are you collecting the data and processing it then?
So what we did was we went in September because we wanted to get a baseline for reading enjoyment level. So we have basic reading level scores. So where did they start in September? How much did they like reading? How confident are they with reading? So we have a whole host of reading outcome measures. And then we have empathy measures. So we're trying to tap into the social emotional competencies scores. So we have family background stuff around, do they have pets at home? Do they like pets? How many pets? What kind of pets? You know, everything that we can possibly know about these children in terms of their connection to the animal world, right? And particularly companion animals in the context of their homes. And we also ask questions about shyness, social preference, and empathy scores, their treatment of animals and what they think about animals, how they treat animals. And so as much as we can get, we got all of that baseline information, as much information as we could get and obtain about how they feel about animals and how they treat animals, and then also empathy and shyness measures. And then we have these other scores around reading as well. So we obtained pre-test data, and then they've been reading to the dogs for the past 10 weeks. We've also observed, are they picking the same dog? They have a choice. They can go to a number of dogs. They can select. We've been observing them qualitatively around how long they read. Are they enjoying the reading process? Which dog do they pick? Is it deliberate? Is it purposeful? Are they exhibiting an attachment for a particular dog each week? Some kids will actually say, I'll come back. I'll come back when my dog is, you know, when that dog is available. So I will wait until that child has finished reading, and then I will come and have my turn because I really want to read to that dog. So they develop this sort of bond over the 10-week period. And in some cases, the kids, it doesn't seem to matter. So they're a little bit more ambivalent ambivalent about that, and any dog will do. And some read longer. Some express they're unhappy at the end of it. They want to keep going. Some are fine to just kind of move along and don't seem as engaged, right? So we're qualitatively observing that process over the 10 weeks and taking notes. And so we've done that. We also have been doing pre-test, post-test data collection for a group of kids who've not been exposed to the dog buddy. So they are really anxiously awaiting. They want to start reading to the dog. So that's something that they're about to start doing. But we really wanted to get a comparison group, because when you look at the empirical literature in this area, very few studies have comparison groups, because it's really difficult to say at the beginning of the year when you're obtaining parental consents, and you're trying to get people really excited about pairing their child with a reading dog buddy, but you have to wait until January. So we want you to consent to doing this. We think it's a great idea. There are all these potential benefits, or this is what we're going to be exploring or looking into, but you have to wait until January. If it was my daughter, I'd be wanting her to have that experience as early as possible, right? So we were lucky enough to have a very generous group of parents who said, that's okay, we'll wait until January, recognizing that we want to produce the best possible study. So we've got pre-test and post-test data for the two groups. One is an intervention group and one isn't, has no exposure.
Would there have been any pushback, for want of a better expression, from some of the parents saying, I don't want my child involved in this? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if maybe some of that may be because they're not quote-unquote pet people themselves, so yes, they don't see the value of it.
Of course, there is always that possibility. It's interesting because we did have a couple of parents in the two classrooms from which we drew our participants who did not want their children to participate. And so they already were not participating. So this would have been last year. We've embedded ways within the research project to not make that obvious to any of the children. So not all children are reading in each classroom right now. Some are waiting. So it's not obvious who's not participating in the study. And there are a couple of children who are reading with their dog reading buddy, but for which we're not collecting data. And so we've try to make that not obvious at all. But it's interesting that you say that. Well, of course, that's an obvious question, but one of the things that I noticed in collecting some of the data is that a couple of children in our study don't have pets at home. And I suspect that's because parents are not. Pet reasons for bigger issues, right? So there may be more ideological reasons why they might not have pets at home, but they're still a part of the study. And so I think people still understand the value of exploring the question, of exploring whether bringing companion animals into an educational context can generate any benefits for children beyond the bond that children are obviously developing with the pets. So I think it's becoming something that is occurring more and more frequently, that children who have disabilities, who have mental health challenges, more and more we're seeing a desire to bring companion animals. So we're also seeing the pushback or the larger question about why are we doing this? But more and more we're seeing that companion animals are making their way into these various contexts in which kids happen to be. So whether it's an educational context, a clinical context. So I think more and more we need to be asking the question, why are we doing this? And to empirically document what is the benefit of doing this? What possible role and benefits do companion animals have in children's lives? I think more and more we're seeing people that are interested in exploring empirically this question, as opposed to, isn't this just a nice thing to be doing? Why is this a good thing?
I wonder if perhaps for the children, some of the attraction here might be the fact that the dogs, generally speaking, are going to be non-judgmental. They are there to be loved. They are there to love you. If you want to read to them, they're going to be fine with that in most cases. Mm-hmm. And for some of the children, that may be a really nice comfort zone for them to be in, because no one is judging them on how they're reading, mm-hmm, or what they're reading, how long it is, anything at all. The dog is just there enjoying the moment. They may connect on that level as well.
That's exactly what's happening. The kids are just really enjoying their time to read to the dogs. They pick the book. They walk up, they pick whatever book it is. It's really cute to watch because they have the dogs in mind. So they will pick a book and say, oh, I think Odie might like this book. And so then they walk walk up to the dog, they sit down, and the Therapy Tales volunteers are wonderful because they really take a back seat. They are there to watch the dogs, to make sure that everything goes okay with the dogs. But other than that, they take a back seat, and these kids are just reading on a mat to their dogs. Some are hugging, holding, lying. They're on top of the dog, beside the dog, and they're reading, and then they want to read another book, and then they read, and they'll sometimes look to the dog and ask the dog a comprehension question and wait for an answer. And so they're really interacting with the dogs, and it's exciting to watch that because there's absolutely no judgmental feedback. There is no correction. You know, these kids are just reading however they want to be, however long they want to read, whatever material, and they decide when they begin, when they end, when they switch books, and how long they read to the dog. I think that's the crux of it. In terms of the reading context, I think that's exactly what's happening. It's a non-judgmental opportunity where kids can read and not be judged for their reading ability.
I was reading online this morning a Book Buddies program the Animal Rescue League of Berks County in Pennsylvania is running. And there was this wonderful picture. It melts your heart because there's this little boy reading with a cat, a good-sized cat, right there snuggled up right beside him. Now, I'm a cat person more than a dog person, so I'm asking this question not so much as a cat person, but just out of curiosity, why just dogs? Because there are other pets that you can connect to.
You know, I think there's issues around allergies. That represents a huge barrier. I think also there are lots of dog people out there, and there are organizations that certify dogs and train dogs, and so they meet these certifications, which they need in order to bring into the schools.
Okay, so it's maybe safer to stick with the dogs.
Perhaps, yeah, yes. But I think logistically, beyond the allergies, I think cats and children work well together just as well as dogs. And in some ways, that might be easier and safer. And so that's an interesting question. It's an interesting difference between cats and dogs in terms of what we assume dogs are able to do that cats cannot do. We assume dogs are able to give us reciprocal feedback that maybe cats, we just assume cats can't do, when in fact they can.
Does the size of the dog influence how this plays out at all? I mean, if you bring in, say, a Labrador retriever compared to, say, a corgi, just for sake of discussion, is there a different reaction from the children? Because the smaller dog may appear to be smaller at their level, whereas a bigger dog may just appear to be a little more intimidating, if you will.
Yeah, you know, of course, that's an interesting question too. I think the kids seem to gravitate to both kinds, so it depends on the child. So some of them like the bigger dogs and they go right for the bigger dogs. It's like the little dogs, perhaps it's like the cat-dog distinction. They immediately gravitate toward the bigger dogs. And they're fine with that. And they put their arms around them. And it's like a big teddy bear. That seems to be what they feel most comfortable with. Whereas other children do seem to gravitate toward the smaller breeds of dogs. And you get the sense that for some kids, for a small proportion, it's because the bigger dog might be a bit more intimidating. So this is a good place to start. Usually the big dogs are big fluffy labs. And so they're not intimidating, right? Usually. So you do see those preferences. And so we just let the kids go to whatever dog they feel comfortable with, and if they back away, then that's fine too. But again, it's really interesting to see some kids who have to have the same dog each week, and they know their names, and they have pet names, you know, like sort of nicknames for their dog already, their reading buddy. And then other kids are okay to explore different dogs. It's like whatever. And I find that really fascinating, because even in the short amount of time, you see that some children, they develop a bond with a certain dog more easily than other kids are doing. So that in and of itself, that's an interesting piece of the study, is just looking at that.
Whatever they have at home, if they have a dog at home, may influence their choice of which dog they want to read with.
Yes, yeah.
Whether they have a big lab at home or a little collie, for example.
Yeah, and whether they have any animals at home. Some of them don't. Some have only goldfish or cats, no dogs. So they're really excited about the dogs. More so than you'd expect, because they don't have any dogs at home. But they're really excited about the dogs because they don't have one and they want one. So we're tracking all of that to see if any of that. And we're just at the point where we're about to, well, we've been entering the data, but now we're about to analyze the data, which is the exciting part for me. Yeah.
Exciting for you, not for
yes,
the kids.
Yes, yeah. No, no, the kids, they're good. They would like to keep going and keep reading. And that's the exciting thing about what we're able to do here is explore something that intuitively people feel works on the ground. So the Therapy Tales volunteers who go each week, they now have to walk away. And these kids, for them, it's a disruption. They're distressed by it. I mean, they'll get over it. But at the same time, they're sad to see their reading buddy leave. And so intuitively, for these people who go each week and who put in all of their time, their animals love it, their dogs, their companion animals, everyone really seems to enjoy this. So in walking away, they intuitively feel that something is happening. So for me, it's exciting because I want to understand exactly what might be happening here. What role do these companion animals have? And so it's nice that we're able to connect that way and to be able to collaborate in a larger research project that does that. And so we're talking long-term and other research projects as well beyond this one.
So you're getting to the analyzing stage of the
yes.
data. How long is that going to take, and when would we expect to see any results from what you're working on here?
We're beginning the analysis part very shortly, probably in March. We hope to have a report by May for Therapy Tales Ontario so that they can report back to their funders, of course. And so we're going to be analyzing the data in the next few months.
Will this be continued in the future? Another program, say, next year at the school? Or is that open to debate at this point?
I think open. Definitely the collaborative piece has gone really well. And so everyone is excited about the possibility of continuing this research project and or developing other projects in other organizations. So again, the other question that people are really interested in understanding a little bit more about is the link between companion animals and children and youth who have or are experiencing mental health challenges. So it's not uncommon in the research for therapy programs to bring companion animals to try to allow children who've experienced trauma and abuse to open up and talk about that abuse with a companion animal. And anecdotally, that has proved to be really helpful. And so children do open up, it's cathartic, they report being able to talk to the companion animal. So beyond that, how is that helpful? In what way is that helpful? There's also a whole research literature that looks at the role of equine therapy for children who have physical disabilities. And so that's kind of a more well-developed body of research. But what about equine therapy for children who have mental health challenges? So again, the issue of mental health is one that I think Tina Hill, the founder of Therapy Tales Ontario, is really keen to explore. And I am as well. And I have some graduate students as well who are interested in exploring that question. So I think that's another potentially research area that we could explore, and as well as what we're doing right now. So I think there's more to come.
The next chapter still to be written.
Of course, yes.
Christine, thank you very much. I'm fascinated by this, and I'm looking forward to hearing what the results are. Will you come back and talk to us again when
course.
You get some results?
Yes, this is a wonderful opportunity, of course.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Christine Tardif-Williams, Associate Professor and Graduate Program Director in the Department of Child and Youth Studies at Brock, on her research into the role animals play in promoting basic social and emotional competencies in children. February, of course, is Black History Month, so a lot has been written and spoken about this month regarding the heroic journey of African Americans from slavery in the days when Harriet Tubman was risking her very life to save others. But slavery is not something only experienced by those African Americans within recent memory. It goes back much further than that and crosses many borders. Earlier this month, a group of graduate students in the Master of Arts in Classics department at Brock held a day-long conference on the theme of International History of Slavery, with a keynote address given by Dr. Michelle George of McMaster University. Two of those graduate students organizing the event joined us in our CFPU studios recently to discuss what came up at the conference, David Ferrig and Tessa Little. And I asked them why they were so interested in the topic of slavery to begin with.
Well, part of it had to do with a class we just had in the fall term with Dr. Allison Glazebrook, who was teaching us about slavery in ancient Greece. And a lot of it came from that class and developed from there, as well as a lot of the recent events that have been going on, different media events, the movie 12 Years a Slave, and February is Black History Month, which kind of motivated us to partly choose it for that reason.
Black History Month is February, indeed. But when we talk about slavery, we're not just talking about the flight of the African Americans to Canada via the Underground Railroad years ago, courtesy of Harriet Tubman. That's a big part of it. But it goes back much further than that, and it's a much bigger problem than just what those people experienced, as bad as it was. That's only part of the picture.
Yeah, I think the institution of slavery definitely is one that is consistently present throughout different historical time periods in all different cultures, and even today it still continues in many areas of the world. So I think that's what makes it particularly interesting to study.
Yeah, I think people may tend to forget that it is still very much a problem, but it takes different forms now. For example, prostitution can be termed a form of slavery. Other cultures where domination appears to be the norm and accepted practice, that in North America we may look at that and say that's abhorrent, can be viewed as a form of slavery as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Prostitution was something that we had discussed as well, sex slavery and those kinds of things. What also people might forget is just how much of an impact it has on the economic side, where as abhorrent as these things are, they contribute a lot to global economies, as sad as that is, and that's something that we're discussing as well, and something that people might forget sometimes.
So the fact that it contributes to the global economy, does that mean that perhaps we tend to not notice it as much because of that fact?
I think the fact that it contributes significantly to the global economy is that, one, how important it is to the people who take these people still and use them for sex slavery and stuff like that. I think we talked in our class that it's a multi-billion dollar industry, sex slavery, throughout the world. So I think that people don't notice it either because they don't want to, because it's happening mostly in other countries. Even though it does happen in the States and Canada, I think that people assume that the sex workers somehow chose this, maybe, if you see prostitutes on the street or whatnot, but they don't think this is slavery. These people are doing this against their will.
So how do we connect the dots, if you will, from ancient to modern times? We're looking at the situation going way, way back, right up to modern times. How do we connect that all together?
To understand how it is today, you have to go back to the roots of it, to understand the processes of domination, different methods of controlling slaves through the way that they dress or through naming practices, all these different kinds of things that go back to Greece and Rome but are still done today. So in terms of connecting the dots, you just see that connection and how there are differences, whereas in ancient Greece and Rome, it wasn't so much racial, but the overall system was pretty similar. And the experience of the slaves, when you read slave accounts, we don't have slave accounts of the ancient world, but you do have them of the modern world, and those are really similar from what we can tell.
And also we know that the slavery in the Americas, for example, they based their slave systems on the Greco-Roman slave systems and used some of those same ideas of dehumanizing and social isolation or social death sort of to help their slave holdings increase, or how to model their slave systems after the Greek and the Roman slave systems. And although, as David said, there were differences, but the actual setup of the institution and some of the practices of these slave owners are, you can make parallels between them.
Now, you touched on the movie, the current hit movie, 12 Years a Slave, which will do much to bring slavery to the forefront again today. But is that really enough? The fact that a movie comes out, we watch it, we realize what the problem is. People need to take more of a lead role in dealing with the problem than just watching the movie, maybe making a Facebook post afterwards about it, and, oh, this is terrible, and then just forgetting about it. That doesn't solve the problem. So what, as a society, can we do to help the situation?
I think you're right. Just watching that movie on its own is not going to solve anything or change anything long term, but it is an important step in getting awareness. And part of our conference as well was, it wasn't just an ancient world conference. There was Christian slavery and slavery in the medieval period. There was slavery in the American South and the Ku Klux Klan. So bringing all these aspects together to inform people that, yes, this is still relevant. And unfortunately, whatever can be done will take a long, long time to actually see the impact of it, because like we were saying, it's so ingrained into the economic aspect of the world today. Any changes will be very difficult and maybe even very hard to see.
So I like the idea of the movie. It's education. You can go and you can get some sort of idea of maybe what slavery was like if you didn't already know. I think the problem is that people will go and watch movies like this and think, oh, that's such a shame, that happened a long time ago. And I don't think we really know or consider how much it happens today. And also, it's not a foreign thing, but it happens in our own countries in our own home. So with our conference, we did deal mostly with ancient slavery, some American slavery, medieval slavery. So we didn't talk too much about modern slavery, but I think the idea of our conference was just to make people aware that it's a global thing. It's not just a cultural thing, not just certain cultures or certain races have slavery, but it's something that everybody in the world has practiced at some point or another, and it still goes on. So I think more education about that would be good.
Now let's talk a little bit about the conference. Tessa, you did not present at the conference, but David, you did. So what were you presenting? Could you sort of encapsulate what you were discussing at the conference?
Sure. My paper was on these four plays by a Greek playwright named Menander, and the women in his plays, specifically the women who were of free status but living with a male character as a sort of concubine, as well as the slave characters who were basically sex slaves, and just how those statuses were very similar to the point that they were interchangeable, and the terms that are applied to these women. How ultimately, however, even though they rise a little bit and can challenge the authority of the male character, ultimately they are put back into their proper subservient roles, and that kind of status quo is what I was arguing.
How big a group did you get together for this? And what can you sense from the reaction of the people to what was being discussed?
Overall, I think there were about 30 people attending the conference. In terms of the reaction afterwards, it was a very positive reaction. People were impressed and pleased with just the variety of topics and the variety of time periods. So overall, I thought it was a very positive reaction.
Yeah, and I think Dave's paper in particular really highlights one of the differences between, I think, modern slavery and ancient slavery. It's so complex, the different statuses that they had, and with these women in particular. So that was really interesting. And then we had papers from the Roman period and from medieval period and Christian slavery and that sort of thing. And so I think all of the papers did a really good job highlighting the differences in slave systems and how complex the tradition actually is. And it was really positive. We had a lot of feedback, a lot of questions, a lot of discussion. So I really think it went really well.
So what should we be taking from the fact slavery is indeed not gone from society today? Just attend a conference and that's it? There's got to be more to it than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Hopefully this will encourage people to become more involved somehow, to think about ways of, if not changing, because that's something that will take a lot of time and more than one person, at least making their group of friends or their circle more aware of it, that it is still relevant, more to open their eyes or open our eyes to, even though we don't see it day to day, it still is relevant and it still is a problem in the world. I agree with you for sure that they're not intended to change things long term or anything like that, but as long as you inform people and make people aware that it's still happening, then I think that's something that is a positive thing.
Yeah, I think making people conscious or to think more critically or look more closely at the institution of slavery, that it's not just a historical thing, but that it's something that continues today, and just make them aware that it still happens. It's still a very big part the global world. So our conference probably didn't change anything long term, but I think it got people thinking, or at least made people aware that this is still something that goes on and something that we should at least think about, if not try to stop.
Do either one of you think there will be an end to slavery anytime soon? Not necessarily in our lifetimes, because that's a finite period of time, more so for me than for either of you, but within a reasonable amount of time, a couple of generations perhaps. Is it realistic to hope and expect that, or given the history, maybe not so much?
I think, especially in this day and age, the youth and the younger people that grow up are more socially aware and socially conscious. So I have hope that it won't continue, but I honestly think that it will continue on.
Because in some countries, it's just ingrained in the culture, and you can't change that quickly. That will take longer than I think all three of us will see.
Right. Like the caste system in India and the social systems in Asian countries and stuff like that, I think are still very much tie them more so to their ancient past than the Western culture. And so I think it's very hard to change somebody's culture and social system. So.
Now, David and Tessa, you're both in the Master of Arts in Classics program at Brock University. So before we wrap up, I just wanted to talk about what you're doing in the course. Where does this lead both of you? What do you see in your future from beyond Brock? Because Tessa, you were at Ohio State before you came to Brock, which I find quite fascinating. But beyond Brock, what lies ahead for the two of you?
I have applied to PhD programs, so I would like to do that and be a professor. If not, I would love to go and work or live in another country somewhere in Europe or Turkey or something like that. So, I mean, regardless, I would like to do something with my degree.
But when you say work, you mean as an educator or
yes.
Beyond that?
as an educator or in a museum or anything like that, something that relates to my passion for history in Europe, of course, in those places, that's where the history is.
So if you're living right there where the history has mm-hmm. been taking place, mm-hmm. you're there's that much closer to it.
Oh, yes.
And David?
As like Tessa said, I would like to stay as much as possible with the field in classics. And I'm not continuing for now, at least on to a PhD. But if I can find a job that keeps me in that university environment, publishing along those lines, I've considered, again, to engage and maybe, if not teaching, then still have a role in some kind of educational aspect with publishing that way.
You know, I found often when I've talked to students from Brock while doing the program that the vast majority of them don't see themselves going beyond their university life outside of a university setting. So I find that the professors and the students are feeding off one another, creating this knowledge base, but they want to continue that beyond their education. It just seems like a natural form. Now, there's only so many positions that are available, so not everyone is going to be able to stay at a university as a professor, for example. But it's just interesting to me how many that's naturally what they want to do. So it's encouraging, I suppose, that the university is engendering this desire in the young people to continue the knowledge, producing information for people to consume. But what if that doesn't happen?
I haven't really planned for that, although I do think about it, that there is a distinct possibility I will not be able to continue in the university field, but I still think, especially in classics, we have such a wide berth of knowledge and qualities and skills that we can work in any field except for, you know, engineering or mathematics or something. But I think that we could work in any field and contribute to any field given our education.
Right. A lot of the skills are transferable, we found. We're also both teaching assistants, so that kind of gives us the background of not only teaching but also personality skills and how to engage with people, how to deal with problems as they arise that some other fields may not have. So if it doesn't continue, there's always a way somehow to disperse that knowledge.
You'll find a way to make it work.
Right.
Yeah. Well, even this conference, I said to Dave, we now have experience communicating with people from different agencies and communicating with our own professors and just organizing something and everything that goes into it. And I think that's a really valuable experience that we could carry into any field.
Tessa, David, thank you both very much for coming in today. I'm sorry I missed the conference, but I'm intrigued by the information that came out of it and the fact that people cared enough to organize this and carry it through and generate some knowledge from it. So thank you both for what you did and good luck in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And there we heard from two of the graduate student organizers of a day-long conference held earlier this month on the theme of International History of Slavery, David Farrig and Tessa Little. And of course, February is Black History Month. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. The next.